6. The Foreign Secretary's issued a grave warning over our safety if secret US intelligence documents are released. The High Court's ruled papers allegedly showing former Guantanamo Bay inmate Binyam Mohamed was tortured in American custody should be made public. He claims Britain knew about the alleged abuse. David Miliband will appeal against the decision, saying it'll affect our intelligence sharing with other countries.
If this material is published, the Americans and others will think our secrets are not safe with the British, and that will make us less safe. So the stakes are very, very high.
A right-wing Dutch politician who compared the Quran to Hitler's book Mein Kampf has been met with angry protests on a visit to the UK. Geert Wilders was only allowed to visit Britain after overturning a ban, which he describes as a victory for free speech. The family at the centre of the runaway balloon saga is to be questioned by detectives over suggestions it was a hoax. Six-year-old Falcon Heaney from Colorado was feared to have drifted into the air yesterday, but he was later found hiding. TMZ.com's got hold of the 911 call made by his father.
Hello? Yes, is this Richard?
Yes, it is.
Okay, how long has the six-year-old been missing?
Just a few minutes.
Was the flying saucer in the backyard?
Yes.
Okay, it obviously has electronics, so he can know how to work it, and he gets it up off the air?
No, he doesn't know how it operates.
A British soldier shot in Afghanistan has had a lucky escape. The bullet lodged in Lance Corporal Ian Maynard's combat helmet, leaving him with whiplash. People are lining the streets of Dublin as Stephen Gately's body is taken to a funeral home. The singer's Boyzone bandmates escorted his coffin back from Mallorca and will stay with him all night ahead of tomorrow's service. And the Royal Mail's going rock and roll with a set of stamps celebrating some of our best-known album covers from the past four decades. That's the latest. I'm Rachel Hardiman.
This is Bristol Community 93.2 FM.
We'll be right back. Welcome back to the show, folks. That was Bob Brassman with Debanesh Bhattacharya and a fantastic track called O Sola Hari. That's from an album of theirs called Mahima. I play that for you with particular interest because Mr. Brassman himself is playing a gig at the Colston Hall on... what kind of date have we got? It is the 27th of November. I'm giving you plenty of advance warning for it because tickets are going to be in very, very short supply for that, I assure you. So get in now, get in early for tickets for that one. However, I'm not here to talk about things you need to pay for. This evening, I'm mostly going to be concentrating on what you can do in the city over the coming week for free. My name is Billy Quain, and if you find yourselves down in and around the area of the docks this weekend, you can go and see on Saturday the 17th, as part of the 100 Days Festival at the Arnolfini, it's the C-Words course, it's Experiments Against Enclosure, Tools to Reclaim the Commons. The Trapeze Collective are running 3-day schools. They're discovering crash technologies, they explore creative vandalism, learn communications tools, debate the economy versus ecology, or join the Feral Choir, all of which you can do. It's a potent and inspiring mix of workshops for collectively changing our world. It's a real gem to try and change things. You know, people always use the adage that charity begins at home. Well, affirmative action also begins at home. If we want to change things, we need to start with doing it ourselves before the politicians will sit up and take note. This week's, as I said, is Producing a Future and Emerging Possibilities. And that's on, it's a free event. There's an awful lot of free events at this 100 days down at the Arnolfini. There's, in fact, too much for me to tell you all about it right now, but that's certainly something worth going to see. Pop along and they have the full literature down there available for you. Now then, there's a drawing debate which is free. This is at the City Museum and Art Gallery. This Wednesday, the 21st coming, there's a drawing debate. It's artists and academics debate the status of drawing in contemporary art. Now, this is maybe slightly involved for some of the listeners. However, it's actually quite a good way. It's a nice in because, as any artist will tell you, there's that lovely quote from Picasso that he could draw like an old master at 12. He had to spend the rest of his life unlearning how to do it. So I think the premise of this also, given the huge success of the Banksy exhibition earlier in the year, I think Bristol City Council and certainly the museum did a fantastic job with that, and I don't think we as a city should be turning our backs on it now that Banksy has moved on. This drawing exhibition, I had a wander in around this afternoon, is fantastic stuff, and it's perhaps maybe not so accessible, and you need to concentrate a little harder on some of the work, but nonetheless it's meritorious of its position up at the museum. Speaking of Bristol City Council museums, we always think that it's the museum at the top of Park Street, and we sometimes neglect the Georgian House, the King's Weston Roman Villa, Blaise Castle House Museum, and also the Red Lodge, which is on Park Street. All of these are free. They're free to get into. They're open from 10 a.m. on Saturday mornings until 5 p.m. And actually, you won't get the droves of people that you get at the others. I bring this to your attention now because Bristol City Council are changing the timetable of opening hours for all of these places after November the 1st. So we have a fortnight. I would warn you that most of them are not open on Thursdays and Fridays. So certainly if you feel at a loose end tomorrow, if you're not listening to my show between 10 and midday, I would urge you to go along to one of the other museums that the city is putting on for free for us. I mean, after all, we are paying council tax for the maintenance of these buildings, and it is incumbent on us to go, I think, and take some joy or learn a little, or even just cast our minds back into the history of the city through the medium of the museums that we've got. Now then, moving on to the Wills Memorial Building, which is, you can imagine what sort of an on-foot route I've taken this afternoon. The Wills Memorial Building at the top of Park Street. There's a succession of free lectures going on at the moment. On October the 19th, there's Dr. Peter Steele, whom some of you may or may not know from some of his other broadcasting work. He's a doctor and explorer, and he's doing a talk, a free lecture, at 6 o'clock, I think, or 8 o'clock, 8 o'clock on Wednesday evening, about his travels from Everest to the Yukon. It's a life of an adventurous medic. So it's a very nice opportunity to get up close and personal with Dr. Peter Steele. He describes his lifelong love of the wilderness, which has taken him from the extinct volcanoes of Tibet Sea to Popocatépetl, someplace in Mexico. There you go. And then on 26th, the following Wednesday, you have got Lord Ronald Oxborough. He's a member of the House of Lords, and he's talking about energy, people and the climate. This lecture is intended to tackle one of the big challenges facing us all: how to produce enough energy for an expanding world population without doing more damage to the planet. So I would urge you to go along and have a look at those. You can find them on the Bristol University website. Now then, my favourite, the Folk House on Park Street. Obviously, I walked up Park Street today, so I picked up some of their literature. Next weekend, not this weekend, this is my favourite festival of the autumn season, I think. It's between the 23rd and the 25th of October 2009. It is the Bristol Harmonica Festival. You can go along to performances and workshops by the best harmonica players in Britain, including Lee Sankey, Brendan Power, Richard Taylor, Tony Stokes, Eddie Ong, Bill Eborn, Ben Hewlett, Frank Seamus, Jerry Ezard, and George Current. And you'd never know, Bristol's own Keith Warmington might put in an appearance at some point as well, because I'll tell you what, he blows a mean harmonica. Prior to that, this weekend, and I haven't got any literature for this, but to say, go along to the Cajun Festival at the Folk House, number 40 Park Street. It promises to be a wow. And I know from personal experience, Steve Parkhouse, who is no longer at the Folk House, but he engendered the place with a tremendous musical heritage, which they're continuing to this day. And the Cajun Festival, you can rest assured, is going to have some great acts. Now, speaking of music, I'm going to go and take another piece. This is by Natasha Atlas. It's called Anahina, from the album of the same name. If you didn't get her at St. George's about 2 weeks ago, you may yet have an opportunity in the spring.
Thank you.
Lovely stuff indeed. There we go. That was Natasha Atlas with Anahina. Obviously, I only gave you a taster of that because I didn't realise just quite how long a track it was. Now then, the big news of this weekend is that it's the West Bristol Art Trail. I promised you there was an awful lot to do for free this week, and the West Bristol Art Trail is 50 locations with over 100 artists displaying their work for free. Many of these artists are displaying their work in their own homes. So even if you don't like the look of their work, you can have a snoop around their houses, can't you? That runs from Saturday and Sunday from 11 a.m. till 5 p.m. As I said, there's over 50 venues, so pick up some of the literature and choose carefully. I have to say the quality of the work that's available on this is extraordinary. Now then, speaking of free stuff, if you can hear me right now, you're not in the Bristol Old Vic basement for the Pay What You Can exhibition by the Scottish Falsetto Sock Puppet Theatre Company, who are pant-wettingly funny. I'm going to track him down and I am going to get an interview with him whether he likes it or not. Also, I would encourage you to go along. It's part of the Bristol Jam Season, which is Britain's first ever festival of improvised theatre, comedy and music and a whole lot else. The one standout for me is Phil Minton with the Bristol Feral Choir, which all ties in again. There is a Feral Choir workshop being held on Monday, the 19th of October. I have an email address for them. It's bristoljam@bristol-old-vic.co.uk. It's a local choir assembled by Phil Minton. It comes with strange and beautiful sounds, exploring all vocal possibilities through improvisation. They were last seen in Bristol at the late Venn Festival. Performances by Minton's Feral Choir have been held all over the world. So if you want a world-travelling Feral Choir, then go along to that on Monday. The concert will be on Tuesday, but go along on Monday the 19th. Now then, skimming quickly forwards at the Watershed. They're doing a lovely season, growing old disgracefully. It's a season celebrating age. This weekend, on Sunday the 18th, at midday, you can go and see Venus with a very, very old Peter O'Toole and Leslie Phillips. It's a beautiful film, actually. I have seen it. And go along for that one. It's 1 hour, 35 minutes long, so you'll be just about ready for lunch after that. Now, we're back to public talks again. In the Folk House on the 28th, I'm giving you a good advanced warning for this. Andrew Charlesworth is doing a talk about the dark side of social networking. Have you ever considered that personal information posted online can be accessed not only by friends and family, but also by employers and authorities beyond your control? Come along to the discussion and find out more. That's at 6 p.m. on the 28th of October in the Bristol Folk House. That is free. Speaking of free things to do, Bristol University again. On Thursday the 22nd of October, there's a lecture of 150 years of Anglo-Japanese relations. The speakers are Dr. Anthony Best of the London School of Economics and Political Science and Professor Arthur Stockwin from the University of Oxford. That's being held in the Watershed. It is free, but you are advised to book in advance. Further details, go to the Bristol University website. Tuesday, there's an autumn art lecture. It's celebrating celebrating in ancient Athens, scenes and painted pottery. I've been to the British Museum, I've seen some of the pots up there. It's quite rude, but go along nonetheless. The speaker is Professor Brian A. Sparks of the University of Southampton, and that one is at the Wills Memorial Building. It's free, no booking required, and it's at 6 p.m. On Monday at 6 p.m, you can go along and see the Paul Esser Memorial and Centenary Lecture from Everest to the Yukon. I've mentioned this already, it's Dr. Peter Steele. That is at the Wills Memorial Building. Last night we missed that one. Thursday. Oh, yes. There's now, speaking of green issues, Michael Michaud is an ethnobotanist and writer. It's at the School of Biological Sciences on Woodland Road. This one isn't free, I'm afraid. It's £3 for guests, free to friends of the Botanic Garden. And he's talking about the world in allotment. And then continuing the green issue, on Friday evening at 7.15 at the School of Chemistry on Cantux Close, there is a lecture, yes, that's what I wanted to say, and it's all about water without borders. If you cast your mind back to the shenanigans going on in Bolivia, I think it is at the moment, where they're trying to nationalise the fresh water supply, or privatise the fresh water supply, I should say. Scandalous. Anyway, Theatre. No, we're going to the theatre. I have been to a lot of it myself this week. In the Brewery, I cannot recommend strongly enough Rum and Vodka. It's a play by Conor McPherson. It's acted most magnificently by a young man from Cork called Owen Slattery, and it's not terribly expensive. I can't recommend it strongly enough, and that is showing until next Saturday. In the Alma Tavern this week, which I've also been to see, it's Showing the Monster. It deals with the issues of the deregulation of the theatre industry in the 1960s after the Lord Chamberlain, and the Theatre Act was made redundant. You will recognise the very famous faces. The girl who plays Diane is Dee Sadler. She was last seen in My Green, Your Grey at the Bristol Old Vic. And John and Ben are played by Alan Coveney and Oliver Millingham, respectively, who you can see at the Shakespeare at the Tobacco Factory Company. Showing the Monster, that is. Finally, Tony is just on his way back into the studio. I would point out that the Compass of Desire Film Festival is still in full swing at the Trinity. And this weekend, you can go and see some cinematic classics from the Lebanon, Sukr Banat, which is translated as Caramel. That's at 6:30, but it includes an introduction, and Waltz with Bashir, which starts at 9 bells, but that is a double bill of those you get for £6 if you're paying fully fledged. Now then, tomorrow evening there's a Fancy Dress Gangsters and Malls. This is still at the Eastern Community Centre. No, it's not. It's at the Trinity Centre. There's a fabulous film by Todd Browning. It's a silent. It stars Lon Chaney, and it's called The Unknown, one of the seminal classics of the era. The dress for this evening, that Saturday evening, is Gangsters and Malls. They're trying to recreate an atmosphere of the seedy cellars and back alleys of 1920s America. Gangsters and malls gather in the town's hottest speakeasy, where the madame, matriarch of the house, waits to welcome her guests, including some of the hood's most notorious characters. Roxanne props up the bar as the local mobsters gamble at a table in the corner. It sounds great fun. I actually want to go now all of a sudden. I haven't got enough time to tell you any more about anything else. However, there's a young Ukrainian lady here who wants to talk to me about football.
Yes. I'm not really a football fan, but I'm from Ukraine. This week, the end of the initial qualification stage for the final of the 2010 Football World Cup to be held in the South Africa. In England's group, England qualified outright with the runners-up Ukraine going into a play-off competition for the remaining unallocated places. The game between England and Ukraine was marked by flyers thrown into the England goal mouth by Ukrainian supporters, an action which could have consequences for Ukraine's plans to co-host the Euro 2012 football championship with Poland. The England team arrived in Ukraine's third largest city, Dnipropetrovsk, having already qualified for the finals. This England loss ensuring the Croatia were effectively knocked out of the competition, Ukraine having had a greater incentive to win. The game's major turning point happened after 14 minutes when England defender Rio Ferdinand badly misjudged a long ball resulting in a clear run on a goal and probably goal for the Ukraine striker Artem Milevsky before he was brought down by the England goalkeeper Green. Green's red card, unfortunately, which followed, left England with 10 men for the most of the game. The resulting Shevchenko penalty was missed. However, Ukraine scored soon afterwards this deflected shot. England never really got back in the game. The new-built stadium did not have the tradition of Ukraine's regular home, the Olympic Stadium in Kyiv, which fits over 80,000 and is currently being renovated to host the 2012 European Championship Finals. This remains for the doubt regarding the hosting of Euro 2012, although UEFA wishes to promote football within Eastern Europe. All its meeting in Zagreb in January 2008, UEFA President Michel Platini warned both host countries that the project had to be improved significantly to allow Ukraine and Poland to retain the organization of UEFA Euro 2012. The executive committee stressed a number of conditions which must be met in order to bring the whole project forward. Both host countries must continue to make the necessary efforts as any Lakanen could put in doubt the organization of his tournament in these countries. The government of both countries must support their national association and fulfill the commitments they gave to UEFA in the scope of the project, notably concerning accommodation and transport infrastructure. Football is a very popular sport in Ukraine and is taught in school. The tournament represents a major opportunity to drive develop forwards within the region.
Fabulous. Well, what are your personal feelings on it? Because if you imagine, for instance, South Africa is hosting the World Cup later on this year, and they don't have a particularly strong footballing tradition, you would argue, not to the same degree that Poland and the Ukraine have, for instance. And they have succeeded in building all of these spectacular facilities on time and seemingly on budget. Do you think the Ukraine can undertake a similar undertaking?
I won't. Ukraine will take part in this, but I hope.
Uh-huh. And would you say that football is the national sport in Ukraine?
Because absolutely. Small boys very like playing football, and really, it's national football.
Excellent stuff. Well, I'm going to change tack slightly. We're going from the Ukraine to Papua New Guinea. The haunting sounds there of the Lani Singers. That was a track called Nit Akumi. Now, these are interesting chaps. I'm going to tell you about the Lani Singers. They come from the remote central highland region of West Papua, on the island of New Guinea in the Southwest Pacific. And they, as you just heard, create deeply emotive. Their songs are rooted in the sacred rituals of the Lani tribe and also embody the powerful modern-day message of their peoples and the struggle for freedom. Speaking of which, I picked this CD up on Monday at the Indigenous Perspectives World Through Different Eyes event, which was held on Columbus Day, Monday the 12th of October, at the Pierian Centre. You missed it. I didn't. Speaking of the Pierian Centre, this Sunday, and I cannot recommend this strongly enough, you do have to pay £6 for this, I'm afraid. You can go and see Mameni Barka. He's the last master of the biram, which is a very ancient instrument from the shores of Lake Chad. It's a five-stringed instrument. It's shaped like a huge boat, and it's got a drum sort of thing. It's very difficult to describe, actually, but it sounds amazing. That is on Sunday at 7. Finally, these are all free. It's the Unchosen film season, which this year is dealing with human trafficking, and they're being screened at St. Stephen's Church in central Bristol, which is just off Colston Avenue. It's the one that's slightly wonky looking, if you look at it, behind where All Bar One used to be, if memory serves me. They're on every Friday throughout November. I would urge you to go and see this, if not to open your eyes to the lack of humanity that pervades in the world, but also you can go along and have a look at the inside of the cinema of St. Stephen's Church, which is a rare treat, actually. Now then, finally, on Saturday the 17th of October from 5 p.m. till late at the Eastern Community Centre in Bristol, you can go along and see You and Your Work 7. It's a free performance festival. This time they've teamed up with Groundwork Southwest in order to be able to provide an even bigger event. Get ready for another instalment bursting with an exciting blend of theatre and performance, delicious world food prepared by Refugee Women of Bristol, and eclectic live music. There is so much to talk about. The Bristol Opera are putting on their performance of Gustav Holst's Perfect Fool next Saturday evening, Saturday the 24th. I mention it now because tickets are in short supply. It's 7:30 in the Trinity Henley's United Reformed Church, and I think the Emerald Ensemble are doing the backing for that. Speaking of classical, we have got the Mozart Festival this weekend at St. George's on Brendan Hill. Moving onwards from there again, if Two Pianos isn't really your bag, on Sunday evening you've got Rango, who are all the way from Sudan. They do Sudanese voodoo music, and as part of the Classical Music Festival, you can go along to some lunchtime concerts Tuesday, October the 20th and Wednesday, October the 21st at the Victoria Rooms, the University of Bristol Victoria Rooms, at the top of Queen's Road. You've got on Saturday Diffracted Terrains, which is a speech, it's a lecture by Dr. Dorothy Curve, the University of Sheffield. However, if Bohemian Piano Trios or more your bag, go along and listen to Jonathan Rees playing the violin, Ewan Davis on the cello, and Jana Frinkelova on the piano, performing a programme including Haydn and Dvorak. That's free, and it's at 1:15 on Wednesday. That is my lot of free stuff. There is an awful lot to do. Tony, how's your week been?
Quite interesting, yes. Been up in London, went up to London one day, actually having a chat to some of these MPs about the expenses scandal. And I was actually asked after the show just now about why didn't we bring up Dan Norris's MP's expenses. And I think, you know, I think we just have to try and get this in perspective, because we're talking about, I think his expenses around about, there was some question over £1,000. And we brought up a story, as you might have heard, about the Ministry of Defence procurement overspending by £35 billion. And I think, you know, you just have to try and get this in perspective, because if anyone's going to stop the banks overrunning the city and bankrupting us all, it's going to be the MPs. So I'm much more in favour of the MPs than I am the banks, personally. Anyway, I know you're not really always up for these hardcore political discussions, but I have to say, 11 o'clock this morning, you know what happened, don't you?
No, I've been busy all day.
The Irish president signed the Lisbon Treaty.
Yeah.
Finally, after the vote last week. The Irish president is someone called Mary McAleese.
Mary McAleese, yes.
And she signed the Lisbon Treaty, making the yes vote in the referendum legally binding. So there's no going back now.
No, I'm afraid not.
And 2 weeks ago, it was actually 2 weeks ago, 67% of people voted in favour of the EU reform deal. Now, as our Irish correspondent, can you let us know what was the reason why, after several attempts, the Irish finally went round and decided, yes, actually, we do love the Lisbon Treaty. We love the European Union.
To be honest, I think they backed us into a corner, really
Did
and
they?
Truly. Oh, yeah. God, yeah. I mean, my biggest bugbear with the Lisbon Treaty was the fact that Ireland were expected to submit troops, because we do have a very small but quite effective army. We've done an awful lot of work with the UN over several years in Sierra Leone, in Liberia, and in the Balkans, and also in Cyprus, way back when Cyprus was a bit of an issue, if you cast your mind back 25 years. And we have a very, very proud reputation amongst the peacekeeping fraternity around the world. You need to remember, obviously, when you're talking about Irish politics, we became a sovereign nation in 1932. So it's less than three generations. So, you know, the idea of Irishness and the idea of proudly being Irish is something that's a very, very new phenomenon to all of us. I mean, my grandfather, I could tell you stories, which I'm not going to incriminate any of the family with, but it's that close, you know, unlike Britain.
But you've now just now given your sovereignty away, haven't
That's
you?
That's just it. And this
so
is why
is
I
that?
Have such a... Well, basically, it was down to
it's
money.
Too hot to handle a bit of sovereignty, is
it? It's not even that. It's just we went absolutely bananas for 15 years on property, and we all, everybody in Ireland got rich, except me, of course, because I was living in Bristol at the time. Everybody in Ireland got rich buying and selling houses to each other, and they never thought for a second that somebody would have to pay for all of these houses. It was just shifting, you know, bills and contracts around a table, and everybody all of a sudden was a paper millionaire. And then, of course, things crumbled down, they toppled down. The one saving grace, maybe, of the Lisbon Treaty is the fact that the minimum wage, I gather, has now been dropped to €1.84 Europe-wide. If you consider what the minimum wage, and even in some of the accession countries, the minimum wage legislation hasn't existed until the treaty was ratified. In Ireland, I know in the UK it's slightly over £5, the minimum wages. In Ireland, it's €9. And if you look at how the euro is facing with the pound at the moment, that's a staggering amount to have to pay anybody to do any work. I mean, even if you get one of the neighbours in to do babysitting, they could throw their toys out of the pram and say, I want €9 an hour.
Well, Martin, I can see your nose twitching there. Are you agreeing with this? Do you think the Irish were right, and you agree with Billy's reasons why you think they voted for the Lisbon Treaty and embracing Europe now?
Can I put it this way? As somebody born and brought up on this side of the Irish Sea, I think it's a matter entirely for the Irish people. I think I understand all of the historical reasons why people were reluctant in the Republic to vote for the Lisbon Treaty. I respect that view. I mean, obviously, the EU as a whole, from a British perspective, might be seen as some kind of corrective to a US power. But I also very much endorse what has been said about the role of Irish peacekeepers around the world, particularly in southern Lebanon, for example, which wasn't mentioned. And the independence of Ireland as a kind of gadfly on the bum of Britain is a very important thing in terms of international politics. And it's a shame that the Irish feels that they've been bullied into voting for something that they don't really want.
But I'm still a bit surprised about all this, though, because I can remember in my history lessons learning that the Irish were the first sort of rebels in the old style British Empire that actually started the whole pack of cards falling to some extent. So if the Irish were absolutely unable to embrace British rule, how come it is that they're starting to now embrace rule from Brussels, from somewhere else?
Well, if I may, there's an awful lot more to... you have a relatively good grasp on history, but the truth of it is, Ireland was never part of the empire. We were a subjugated nation race. Not at all, you know, we were pink on the map, and that was about it. If you go back through the mists of time, to the flight of the earls in the 1600s, to the Jacobean rising, which mainly centred on Ireland. You can also go back to Cromwell, and it goes miles and miles back to the Anglo-Saxons. I read a relatively interesting book and illuminating a travel book, funnily enough, which taught me an awful lot about Irish history. However, we managed finally to wrest independence. We gave up our independent parliament. That was the other thing about Ireland. We had an independent parliament until 1801, and the Act of Union signed that away. So the parliament that was sitting in Dublin then went over to Westminster. The caveat of sitting in Westminster at the time was that you had to swear an oath of allegiance to the Queen as head of the Church. Obviously, with Ireland being a predominantly Catholic country, any elected Catholics were unable to take their seat in the Parliament, which subjugated them even further, because the feudal landlords were the feudal landlords who had been planted there by Elizabeth I were the only people who were sitting in Parliament. So decisions that were being made on Ireland's behalf were being done by British people who were on effectively an asset strip of the country, which culminated in the predator famine of 1844, 45 and 46. I hope I haven't gone a little
really
bit too detailed
yeah.
into it, but we were never, I stress again, we were never part of the empire. We were a subjugated people within an empire that really didn't pay any attention to us apart from getting butter and grain out of us.
So were you surprised, Martin, when the Irish finally, after three different attempts to
not
get
really,
them to sign
I think,
up to this?
I think it's quite interesting if you compare what's happened in Ireland with what's happened in Iceland. I think in Ireland the crisis, the economic crisis, has led people to cling to nurse for fear of worse. And the idea that the EU can somehow help them through the crisis, I think, has been decisive in shifting opinion within Ireland. But in Iceland, of course, the bullying by Britain and the Netherlands in particular about the repayment of private sector debts by the people of Iceland, because they've been forced to take over these debts, they are actually moving away. They were thinking of applying to join the EU and moving in that direction. But there's a political crisis going on now in the government in Iceland, because people are beginning to say, well, actually, we don't want to join the EU. It's actually going to make things worse. And they're actually talking about things like repudiating the country's national debt and so on. And I suspect before the end of this crisis, there's going to be an awful lot more of this. I think that it's a shame in a way that the Irish have been bullied where they didn't want to go. But in that sense, I support entirely the position that's been put forward here. But I think we've also got to think in bigger terms of how do we stop US power from aggrandising, and that I think we do need to work together on that if we're going to do anything successful.
One of the things that worries me, that a lot of the big corporations at the European Roundtable of Industrialists and people like this are actually the same people who are funding the parties in the United States who are actually putting forward the new policies for the European Union. Ultimately, was it the right thing to do, Billy?
Well, it's difficult, because I'm glad you, this is one of the other divisive issues. Bearing in mind, the Lisbon Treaty is over 300 pages long. I mean, it's a fairly hefty tome of legislation or so. The corporation tax in Ireland, which was primarily responsible for the boom in the Irish economy in the last 15 or 20 years, an awful lot of multinationals have their European headquarters in Ireland because we built factories for them, we built industrial estates for them, and then we charged them 18% corporation tax on all of their profits. So Ireland has been a massive sinkhole for an awful lot of foreign money for a long time. The beginnings of the end is the signing of the Lisbon Treaty, because it's not included in this treaty, but as you know, Europe works incrementally. There will, 15 years hence, certainly be a streamlining and a cross-border taxation strategy, certainly with regards to corporation tax. And countries like Ireland, who have done very, very nicely, and don't get me wrong, I mean, Europe has handed us a huge wad of money, a lot of which has been squandered, but you can drive around the country in comfort now and in ease. The rail system is beginning to work. The schools are very good. The universities are top class. But, as with any creditor, they will expect some payback at some stage. And once the corporate taxation has been streamlined across Europe, and everybody, I think they'll probably plump for a figure somewhere around 28% to make sense of it, because in the UK I think it's 32 or so, in Ireland it's certainly less than 20. And once that happens, all of these companies are going to whip themselves out of Ireland, they'll move off someplace, probably on the fringes of Europe again. You might find them going to Turkey or somewhere like that. And then that'll be the end of it for the Irish economy. Apparently one quarter of the Irish GDP is generated by American multinational companies, which is absolutely scandalous to be that reliant.
Scandalous, absolutely scandalous. And there's only one thing to do now, and that's to do this.
Suri la dunin, nurse the dulaman, the weirga, dulaman, the bin, the wee, Dulaman the Gaela, Dulaman the Bindabwe, Dulaman the Gaela, and on to whom ye nurse the Dulaman the Gaela, Fudulami, yes, the Dulaman the Weeker, Dulaman the Bindabwe, Dulaman the Gaela, Dulaman the Bindabwe, Dulaman the Gaela, the Haman the New Lash, Dulaman the Gaela, Canamabrogadi, that's the Dulaman the Gaela, Dulaman the Bindabwe, Dulaman the Gaela, Dulaman the Bindabwe, Dulaman the Gaela, Broga Black, do air a Dulaman the Gaela, Barada Gastrus, air a Dulaman the Gaela, Dulaman the Bindabwe, Dulaman the Gaela, Dulaman the Bindabwe, Dulaman the Gaela.
And that was a track there from the Rough Guide to Irish Music, and it was called, I think, Cran. I don't know if you can pronounce this
number 12. It is Cran, and it's by Dolman and Charlie O'Neill's Highland Band. So there you have it, and it's under license from the Cross Border Media. That's an interesting track because it's from the north of the country.
Is it?
It's from County Armagh, yes.
Oh, gosh, so really, it was entirely inappropriate.
No, it's fine, because it's strangely, as I was mentioning, the Flight of the Earls and all this sort of stuff back in the 1600s, an awful lot of Scottish Protestants came over and planted Ireland, similarly to how the Irish Gaels had gone and planted Scotland maybe 800 years earlier. So we have a shared musical ethnology, as they say.
Okay, so whilst Martin is telling us a bit more about the plantations of Ireland, can you just select another more appropriate... I think we really ought to have something from the Republic, since we've just been spending the last 10 minutes talking about the Republic. Martin, what about this? The plantations? Can you just tell us about that?
Well, I mean, it's already been mentioned. There's a long, sad history of Britain aggressing against the people of Ireland and planting, basically depriving the locals of their land and planting settlers in their place, which is still going on, of course, in places like the West Bank. Today,
do you think this? I mean, the peace process, though, as we've seen the last 7 or 8 years, it's really an example to other parts of the world where this is a problem. I mean, even places like Indonesia, people are being moved across, literally put in ships and moved across vast parts of the continent and planted in the similar way that's happened in Ireland.
I don't think plantation is the main issue in contemporary Ireland.
No.
Although, of course, the ramifications clearly are because of the unionist tradition in the north of the country. Why are we talking about plantations? Because it's
it's a little bit of interesting bit of history that not everybody knows about I got a lesson about Irish history. The only time I've ever got a really good lesson about Irish history was on the ferry on the way from Holyhead to Dublin, from a farmer explaining to me, well, did you know about this? Do you know? Hang on a minute, I didn't get taught about that at school, because you actually do get taught. That's quite a biased view, I think, in history classes in England.
That lovely quotation from Winston Churchill when he said, history will be kind to me because I intend to write it. And obviously you two, being educated in the UK, read the British history books, so you're only getting one side of a fairly slanted story at that point.
Well, I mean, to be honest with you, I mean, I have read the Irish View as well. It's, I think, referring back to what we were saying earlier, when Collins was negotiating with Churchill and Lloyd George in the run-up to the original treaty in 1920, either Churchill or Lloyd George said to Collins, said, Michael, we could give you home rule, but what would happen then? Think about India. And Collins's reply was, that's your problem. And I think that the Irish struggle against British imperialism over the generations has been a very, very useful thing for leveraging freer attitudes towards the social realities in our own country, and also, of course, breaking the shackles of imperialism in other parts of the world, particularly, for example, in India.
Okay, so thanks, Billy. You found another song which actually is from the Republic.
It most certainly is. This is Dolores Cain. She's of travelling extraction and she's from West Galway, which ironically is where an awful lot of the Armada ships ended up after they were routed from the Channel, because they went around the north of Scotland and managed to get themselves wrecked on the Galway coast.
How did they do that? Just the bad navigation?
No, the weather turned on them.
Okay, so you get a strong west wind blowing you into the rocks.
Yeah,
I suppose there's not a lot you can do.
The craggy shores of the west of Ireland.
At the time, it was regarded as a Protestant wind. And God was on our side.
Children, it's the land you cannot own. The land owns you. It's the land, it is our wisdom. It's the land, it shines us through. It's the land that feeds our children. It's the land you cannot own. The land owns you.
from the Rough Guide to Irish Music. That's Dolores Keen and Solid Ground. Now, if we have a little look now at some of the events from Prompt Magazine, that's the Avon Association of Drama, where you can find them on the internet at avondrama.org.uk. Some of the amateur dramatic and similar types of performances that are coming up over the next week or so. The 17th, that's tomorrow evening, Shakers Restirred by John Goodber and Jane Thornton. That's by the Portishead Players at Somerset Hall in Portishead, 7:30. Tomorrow at, and the number is 01275 843169, if you're interested in that. Although actually it's probably easier to find the Avon Drama website if you're on the internet. And the also tomorrow is The Bird in the Hand by Derek Benefield, the Kingswood Players. That's at Kingswood Community Centre at 7:30. There's also the Saturday Matinee at 2:30. Now, the big event of the year is to do with amateur drama entirely around the entire region is happening on Sunday evening. That's the 18th. That is the Rose Bowl Awards. That was we mentioned briefly last week at the Winter Gardens in Weston-super-Mare at 7 o'clock, where the guest speaker will be Cameron McIntosh. That's Sunday evening, and we hope to have some report from that next week. And between the 20th and the 24th, Les Miserables, the school edition, is on by Alan Boubil and Claude Michel Schoenberg. That's the Bristol Music Youth Productions at the Redgrave Theatre, Clifton, at 7:30. And the Sunday matinee will be at 2:30. We Happy Few is on by Imogen Stubbs, and that's the Kelvin Players, the Kelvin Studios, at 7:30. That's between the 20th and 24th of October. The Happiest Days of Your Life by John Dighton, the Cleveland Players, at the Prince's Hall at 7:45, and that's running from the 21st to the 23rd. Finally, The Perfect Fool by Gustav Holst, and that's Bristol Opera, and that's Trinity United Reformed Church in Henlees at 7:30 on the 24th of October. Also, I'd like to mention some stuff that's coming up at the Arnolfini this weekend. I was just emailed something this afternoon at the last minute about this, so I have a quick run through. It's called Living Sustainably and Organising Cooperatively. That's on Saturday, tomorrow, the 17th of October. The opening session's between 10:30 and 11:30, and it's Introductions, Autonomous Futures and Direct Democracy. Paul Chatterton on the trapeze. Well, I'm not sure he's actually going to be talking to you on the trapeze, talks about creative possibilities of direct action on autonomy for a sustainable future. Actually, I think Paul is from an organisation called Trapeze, and there's workshops throughout the day. There's another, the following Saturday, there's some more of this, but there's community gardening, how to use urban space and green up our local ecologies, economics versus ecology with Will Brown explaining the way the economy works, and there's consensus decision making and facilitation, a training of tools and methods to break down hierarchies and work effectively with groups with Alice Cutler and Kim Byron. And then there's lunch between 2 and 3 and more workshops in the afternoon. Crash technologies in urban settings. Marvel at grey water and water filtration systems. Create floating rubbish islands. Portable bioremediation service devices constructed from urban detritus. So it sounds like lots of recycling and that sort of thing going on at the Arnolfini tomorrow. And that's also coming up the weekend after. That's Saturday the 31st of October too. Now, finally, Martin, let's just discuss this story, which I think has been quite fascinating, really. The Starsuckers film is about to come out. And this was reported on The World Tonight on Radio 4 last night, and also in The Guardian today. Atkins and his producers of this film have decided the answer to too much celebrity is to just see how much they can get away with. And they phoned up many of the national newspapers and succeeded in getting all sorts of stories about celebrity into them. The irony here is, I mean, for example, what they say here in The Guardian today is within a fortnight, almost every daily tabloid newspaper in the UK had published one of their false stories about, bogus stories about the likes of Amy Winehouse, Pixie Geldof and Guy Ritchie. And the irony being that afterwards, and in the same, I think actually it was the day before's edition of The Guardian, The Guardian have been gagged from reporting Parliament. Now, what is going on? We're reporting false stories about celebrities, but we're not allowed to report Parliament.
Well, it's a sad state of affairs, isn't it, Tony? What do you expect me to say? I mean, I think the problem is it's very difficult to get people to take serious things seriously if their minds are full of things which are not so serious. And a lot of what goes on is that people have only so much attention and their minds are filled with things that are not so serious. But
you
of course, you know, people do need a lighter side of life, but it just shows how self-referential this whole celebrity game has become. And potentially dangerous in the sense that it makes people lose sight of what's important.
Okay, thanks, Martin. That's it for this week. See you next week.